I'm at the Australian Centre for Photography, talking with Ben Bohane.
It's called The Black Islands, Spirit and War in Melanesia.
And Ben, first of all, can you tell us about the areas that are depicted in this exhibition, the region that you're currently working in?
Yeah, I'm taking what we call the ethnographic Wallace line, so everything basically east of Flores Island in eastern Indonesia. So we're talking about Timor, Maluku, West Papua, into PNG, Solomons, Fiji, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, and parts of Black Australia also, where Australia, we've got particularly through Torres Strait, which is indigenous and Melanesian.
So we're talking about some of Australia's closest neighbours, but how much knowledge do you think the average Australian would have of this region?
I think it's pretty poor these days, but I sometimes wonder whether it might be a generational thing, in that I think our grandfathers and great-grandfathers probably had a much better handle on the region, because once upon a time, you know, to get to Australia before the age of flight, you had to come by boat, and that meant coming through the Pacific Islands. And so I think previous generations, ironically, probably had a better understanding of the immediate region, plus, you know, the Australian colonial legacy in Papua New Guinea and working through various administrations in the region. And certainly the Second World War was a big factor for a big chunk of the Australian population. But these days it seems as if, you know, Melanesia has kind of gone off the radar a little bit over the last 20 years. It's only now that we're seeing Australian military interventions all through the region that sort of come back on the agenda again.
Do you think Australians are disengaged with their neighbours?
I think we are at a political level and a variety of sort of social and artistic levels as well. I think there is a bit of a disconnect. I get concerned when, you know, so much Australian policy towards Melanesia is political in nature and geared around things like good governance and law and order and these sorts of, all the sort of sharp end of aid. And, okay, that's necessary, but at the same time, I think it doesn't put flesh on the bones of a kind of relationship that's more than just politics and sort of security issues. It seems like there's no sort of great interplay of artists, for instance, you know, where are the poets and painters and sculptors that are, you know, really engaging with the immediate region and vice versa? Why is it so hard for Melanesians, our nearest neighbours, to even come and visit Australia on tourist visas? So I think there is a little bit of a disconnect, and maybe now that we're starting to see these interventions going on through the region, maybe that will trigger a sort of renewed push by, you know, a new generation of Australians into the region to have a better understanding of our immediate region.
And what's your personal engagement with the area?
I've been covering the region for about 12 years. It sort of started when I first began covering the Bougainville War.
As a photojournalist?
Yes, as a photojournalist. And that continues through till today. I mean, these days I do quite a bit of TV producing, a bit of shooting and reporting as well. I mean, as someone that sort of specialises in this region, I'm trying to get these stories across in a variety of mediums. You know, who knows, maybe 10 years from now I might pick up a paintbrush or something. But I think I'll always have an interest in this particular region. I find, you know, it's a treasure trove of great stories.
So your interest is partly creative then? It's an artistic interest as well?
Yeah, I certainly get stimulated in an artistic sense. I don't consider myself an artist. I've always seen myself as basically a working photojournalist who's made a living from, you know, being able to do stories through the region in a variety of mediums. But I think, yes, if you have a creative sort of instinct, it's hard not to be influenced when you come across these incredible landscapes and really dynamic cultures, and you're bound to sort of take some of that on board.
So these images you would classify as reportage, they were intended for media outlet. Did you ever think that they would end up on gallery walls?
No, I never thought they'd wind up on gallery walls. Well, I just never took the photographs with that in mind. All these photos were really taken in my capacity as a photojournalist as sort of photos to either illustrate a story or in their own right as a photo essay. I always figured they'd wind up in magazines and newspapers. But since the market for photojournalism, particularly hard reportage, seems to be dwindling, and ironically it's not because of sort of depressed economic states, but in fact it's because we've never been more affluent, and we've got the rise of sort of lifestyle, what I call the triumph of kind of lifestyle content, where people don't really want to sort of engage with anything that's too disturbing or anything that takes you out of your comfort zone. So a lot of magazines and newspapers that would have traditionally, 10, 20, 30 years ago, been very strong on reportage, now, barely even acknowledge that the medium exists.
And in terms of some of the situations that you find yourself in, looking at the photographs, one senses that you're in a lot of danger or in dangerous situations. Can you tell us, is that the case, and is the danger that is coming through in the images reflecting cultural or political situations that are going on in those locations?
Yeah, look, it's been a fairly turbulent period. We've seen a lot of coups and conflict through the region. I don't go looking, for combat necessarily, but often I've been in situations where it's come to me, and you've just got to be able to kind of find a way of dealing with that. Yeah, I mean, we've seen a situation with a lot of failing governments through the region, issues of corruption and poor governance, and that's the usual sort of diagnosis for a lot of these problems we see. My personal interest was to sort of go deeper and look more at the spirit world that these cultures inhabit. And I think that through that window you can get a much better understanding of why we're seeing these kind of movements, resistance movements and syncretic kind of cults, cargo cults and custom movements arising. And they play a very significant role in the political stability of these countries as well. I think they've been a much underreported and unanalyzed sort of aspect to why we're seeing so much conflict in the region.
Yeah, can you speak a little more to that, the connections between the spirit realm, I guess, and the cults, etc., and the resistance movement, and also give us one or two really specific examples of a people and a place and how their beliefs are unfolding?
Yeah, it's been part of my practice as a photojournalist. Part of my passion is theology and comparative religion, and so when I covered the war in Burma and Cambodia for 4 or 5 years before coming into the Pacific, I steeped myself in Theravada Buddhism. Likewise, from my time in Afghanistan, Indonesia, these sorts of places, I tried to look at it through a prism of Islam and some types of Islam, Sufi Islam, which I'm particularly interested in. So when it comes to the Pacific, we've got various layers. You've got a Christian layer. Now we're starting to see the rise of Islam through there. Plus you've got these Christian and syncretic kind of cult movements. Some of them are sort of wrongly labelled cargo cults, when in fact they're the opposite. They're an anti-cargo kind of movement. But I find that a particularly interesting way of looking and gauging how these conflicts arise, and that began partly out of that first Bougainville trip where I spent time with the rebels and then was introduced to a Sangoma man, to a sorcerer, which made it very clear that the rebels were actually the BRA. When they first went bush and began operations against the mine, they found sanctuary with a cult movement called the 50 Toya movement. In the course of continuing to cover the Bougainville War and then, the Solomons, West Papua, elsewhere, I began to see a pattern emerging where these cult movements played a very significant role in the conflicts. That's partly why I decided to really sort of focus in on them.
Just, for instance, give us a little bit more information about the video that is playing in the exhibition. There appears to be some kind of ceremony going on that's a kind of a worship of the US.
Yeah, there's a little video that I worked on with a filmmaker called Bentley Dean. I took him down to Tanner Island in southern Vanuatu, where you have the John Frum cult. This goes back to sort of pre-World War II, but essentially this movement continues to raise the Stars and Stripes every Friday. And it's kind of ironic at a time when anti-Americanism around the world is at a sort of crescendo. Here is a remote little group in a sort of island in southern Vanuatu that raises the US flag and dreams of the day that America invades again. And that stems from, you know, it's a classic World War II cargo cult where they found a great sort of revelation almost in the way the American troops came into the region and the social revolution that created through the Pacific Islands has been sort of, you know, very underestimated. Up until World War II, most of Melanesia were either French, British or Australian colonies. And you had it was a very kind of colonial style administration in many of these places. Some of them were quite tough. A lot of islanders were basically barefoot working on copra plantations and uneducated with very little opportunity to sort of really control what was going on around them. And there was a great divide essentially between the whites and the blacks in those sort of territories and in that sort of social circumstance. So when the Americans arrived in the Second World War, for the first time islanders saw a kind of juggernaut coming through that had black American soldiers, and for the first time they saw a great sense of equality between whites and blacks. They saw them wearing the same uniforms, eating the same food, sleeping in the same tents. And it was this kind of egalitarianism, I think, and the generosity as well of supplies, medical equipment, food. Everything was sort of dispersed in a very generous sort of manner. And so we saw a whole, you know, there's a whole flourish of these kind of movements after the war, where islanders realized that they never wanted to go back to the old colonial style of governance. And so these movements kind of adapted and mutated, and you know, some of them still going, including the John Frum cult in Vanuatu.
There's a section in the subtitles where he's saying that they're still waiting on the next shipment of cargo to come in from the US, but it's kind of overdue by now.
Yeah, well, look, they're sort of waiting for the cargo, but as some of them have pointed out, you know, sometimes they'll have Europeans coming in and saying, "Hey, don't you think it's a bit silly that you've been waiting the last 70 or 80 years for this cargo and for the second coming of John Frum?" To which Chief Isaac and many of his followers will say, "Well, who are you to talk? You've been waiting for Jesus Christ to come for 2,000 years." So you know, it's all comparative. But yeah, it's a curious sort of mix of basically the John Frum movement wanted to protect their local customs from the impact of missionary Christianity, particularly the Presbyterian missionaries who came there through the 20s and 30s and basically told them they couldn't sort of drink kava or dance or, you know, make love or basically have any fun. There was basically a ban on fun of all kinds, and I think the locals just decided they'd had enough, and so they created this mythological divine sort of presence that they called John Frum. Nobody's really sure exactly who he is or what it means, but it was a way of sort of defending their own custom. And then when the Americans arrived, it was sort of a fulfillment of prophecy in a way, and that's why it's given the movement its longevity.
And do you find joy in these cultures? I mean, there's a lot of intensity going on in the images. Is there a lot of joy there as well?
Oh, every day is joyful for these people. They live in beautiful environments generally. They're fairly self-sufficient in terms of food. No one tends to go hungry in the Pacific. There's not, certainly compared to Africa and parts of Asia, you know, they've got a lot less to complain about. I mean, yeah, there's a great sort of joie de vivre, you could say, in daily life in this region that's filled with music and storytelling and all kinds of things.
Were you in East Timor for some of the recent upheavals that went on there?
Not for the recent upheavals, no. I was in East Timor for the first month of independence when Interfet first went in and covered that first month.
I just wanted to talk to some of the specific images of photographs that you've got on the walls. Let's start with this one right behind us here. An Australian Indigenous soldier, is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, this is a Norforce soldier up in Groote Island, which is up in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I like it just because it's a quite sort of meditative photo, but it's something that most Australians wouldn't be aware of. But, you know, the black communities of the Top End are our first line of defence. They're the eyes and ears of our northern coastline, so it sort of makes sense to engage them. And I had a wonderful couple of months in the bush with a Norforce unit, which is made up almost entirely of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander soldiers. There's different units through the Top End of Australia, and they sort of see it as creating a third way. It's not white fella way, it's not black fella way, it's a sort of third way. And when they all put on the same uniform, then they all kind of work together. And it's been an interesting sort of exchange. You know, they teach, the Aboriginal soldiers teach the white soldiers, you know, where they can find food and water and how to survive in very inhospitable terrain up there. And likewise, you know, they're able to get the latest sort of infrared and night vision, this and that, you know, the latest high-tech kind of weaponry. And so for them, it sort of gives them a bit of pride, and they tend to be some of the more motivated men in those communities. You know, often there's very little employment in those communities and all kinds of social problems. Most of the elders kind of really get behind it, and I saw it as one of the as a really sort of positive Aboriginal story from the Top End.
Mm. Are there any particular images in here that you would classify your favourite photographs that we could go and talk about?
I don't know if there's any one in particular, but there's a couple here that we could alight on. This one here I feel strongly about. This was out on patrol with PNGDF and resistance forces in Bougainville. And in a way, it kind of sums up a lot of what I've been trying to get across with this exhibition and a lot of my work. Earlier in the day, the BRA had come into the village I was based in with the DF, and they'd shot and killed a 12-year-old boy. So we then responded, went out on patrol, and I came into this moment. There'd been a grenade or two that had gone off, and I came onto this scene. And it just so happened that the guy in front of me, this resistance guy in front of me, had this helmet with graffiti on the back of his helmet that said Cultist Land, Starlight, Charlie 1, 97. And so with the smoke and grenade sort of behind it and the guys sort of hovering round and this graffiti, it kind of it encapsulated a lot of what I was trying to get across, which was the role that sorcery and custom was playing in the conflict there. And also the way that traumatised a lot of the soldiers, you know, for a lot of the PNG Defence Force soldiers that went in there, because they'd come from highland villages themselves that were very steeped in their own traditions of sorcery, etc. They also believed that the BRA had very strong sorcery, and so, for instance, they were concerned whenever they saw dogs around their perimeters. They used to kill any dogs that they'd see around because they believed that they could have been BRA who'd had the ability to transform themselves into animals and reconnoiter their positions. But it also created a lot of the fear and trauma that they went through going through the bush and being alive to all the possible sort of spirit and sorcery that could be used against it. I mean, from an Australian perspective, we might find that kind of crazy or something, but from an Indigenous perspective, it was a very real thing for them.
And we're looking at the backs of the heads of these soldiers, but nevertheless, they appear to be quite young. Are they young?
Yeah, this guy in front was sort of a bit of a guide, so you know he was quite a young fella. The others were sort of a little bit older, but yeah, this was a kid. He couldn't have been more than sort of 16 or 17, I'd say. Who was sort of leading the way.
you're right there in the thick of the action. Are you there in an objective sense, or are you subjective?
I would say wholly subjective. Yeah, I'm not interested in objectivity. I think as a photojournalist, as a reporter, it's very important to have balance and to be conscious of being balanced as much as possible in any situation. But for me, the word objective sort of denotes a kind of clinical separateness from what's going on. And I don't think, A, that that's possible. And secondly, I don't think it's something to aim for, creating that distance between yourself and what's going on. You know, it's not that I'm necessarily a participant or supporting or whatever, but, you know, I'm subjective in that I'm dealing with human relationships here, and I see it from a particular perspective, and I'll always try and present a balanced view, but ultimately I'm going to fall on one side or the other. I'm not really interested in sitting on the fence, you know, in a lot of these situations.
So in a situation like this, you would sympathise with the ambitions of the rebels then?
No, I mean, in the case of Bougainville, I think, you know, in general, they've always had a sense of separateness from the rest of PNG. Traditionally, their trade links and ancestral bloodlines essentially were much more related to the Solomon Islands, to Western Province in the Solomon Islands, and it was really just a colonial stuff up that Australia included included Bougainville as part of Papua New Guinea. It should never have been included as part of PNG when PNG got independence in 75, and that's kind of what helped create the war.
In a situation like this, is there a place for round table discussions of peace, or are these guys basically interested in action?
No, I think there's always room to sit at, you know, and smoke the peace pipe, sit around a table and try and nut through it. I mean, it's interesting to see the role that custom played in a place like Bougainville, which, like a lot of matrilineals, like a lot of Melanesian societies, is matrilineal. It's women who own the land, not men. So women played a key role in instigating the conflict. They gave their men the spiritual legitimacy to begin operations against the mine, believing that the mine had no longer any legitimate right to be involved there. They'd failed to sort of negotiate, etc. But equally, after 10 years of war and 15,000 dead, it was women who put pressure on the BRA and other Bougainvillean groups to try and give diplomacy a chance. So that's where you can see the role that custom and women, particularly in this situation, played. And they're, you know, they were very keen to have peace, not peace it at any cost, but certainly, you know, to try and find a negotiated settlement that would lead to an act of self-determination.
A lot of the images are of men. Is it easier for you as a man to go into those situations and point your camera at men rather than women or groups of women?
No, I mean, I found it's open to all. I've been warmly welcome wherever I've gone. I've shot, you know, a lot of women, kids. You know, I'm looking at sort of society in general, and there's, you know, quite a few images in this exhibition relating to that as well. But certainly in terms of the conflict, we're now standing in the conflict section, and of course that's going to be dominated, you know, by guys. But no, I think, you know, as I was saying before, the whole matrilineal element of a lot of Melanesia makes it important that you kind of get that perspective. But certainly I'm going to have a better access to dealing with sort of men's business. And likewise, I see women photojournalists who get in and are able to get better access to sort of women's groups and some of their own customs.
Yeah. Just finally, most of the images are black and white, but there's a few beautiful colour images. Can we just talk quickly about this colour image here?
This is a group of guerrillas from the IFM, which is the Isatabu Freedom Movement. That Isatabu is the traditional name for Guadalcanal, what we call Guadalcanal. And I shot this at a waterfall while we were kind of out doing a little patrol. I've shot most of the exhibition in, you know, most of the stuff here is black and white, but it was just such a rich kind of colour, and some, you know, this kind of dank primordial kind of colour of blues and aquamarines and green. I just sort of would give it a little dash of life. But yeah, this is at a waterfall on the south coast of Guadalcanal, where they're trying to sort of protect their lands from the Malaitan Eagle Force, which had taken power through the coup and was kind of raiding a lot of these areas.
And the greenery that they're wearing, is that for actual camouflage purposes, or is just as decoration for the joy of decoration?
Yeah, no, it's a mixture of kind of camouflage, but also, you know, they're wearing the cabalata, which is a traditional bark loincloth. This is in a custom area. The guy in the front here is the son of the chief Moro, who took his people back to a completely traditional way of life, which means, you know, you go into the villages and it looks as if you've stepped back in time. There's no real concessions to the modern world there. The men wear the cabalato bark loincloth, the women are in arsegrass, and basically they kind of live a fairly traditional way of life there.
Will these images go into a book?
Yeah, ultimately this will be part of a book which may have a similar title, but that'll be the next project. Now that I've got the exhibition up, it's taken me several months just to edit through, you know, 12 years of work, and it's been a great process just to kind of go through that volume of material. And now that it's kind of narrowed down, I think I'll start putting a book dummy together.
And where are you based these days?
I live in Vanuatu, so I'm based in Port Vila, the capital, and use that as my base for the region.
And what do you think will be unfolding in the near future that you might need to go into?
Look, it's a very dynamic and inherently unpredictable region, so you never know what's around the corner. But I think, you know, I think Papua New Guinea will remain a big challenge, you know, for Papua New Guineans and Australians and those interested in the region. There's a number of issues there that will continue to make it a very important strategic sort of issue for Australia, and one that will force us to re-engage there on a very significant level in the future.
All right, Ben, thanks very much.
Pleasure.